You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump's proposed budget contains some breathtaking cuts to programs like housing subsidies, child care assistance, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and many other programs that serve the poor. HUD Secretary Ben Carson's comment in a recent interview on SiriusXM gives us a clue of what's behind this. He was asked what could be done to reduce the large number of people living in poverty.
I think poverty, to a large extent, is also a state of mind. You take somebody who has the right mindset, you can take everything from them and put them on the street. And I guarantee you, in a little while, they'll be right back up there. And you take somebody with the wrong mindset, you can give them everything in the world. They'll work their way back down to the bottom.
So we begin a series looking at the so-called working poor, who they are, what challenges they face, and what policy changes might help the most people. With us now is Kristen Seafelt. She's an assistant professor at the School of Social Work and the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Her new book is Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. Kristen, your book explores roadblocks to upward mobility for low-income families, the poor, the working poor, people who use the safety net. What does that term working poor really mean?
The way I think about it is people who hold jobs, you know, maybe they don't work full time, maybe they don't work full year, but their income is low enough that it puts them below the federal poverty line. So for a family of three, for example, you know, we're talking roughly about $25,000 a year would make that family poor by an official measure. You know, and certainly we can argue whether or not that's enough to live on, but that's how the Census Bureau defines it.
And in your book, you studied 45 people in the Detroit metro area, and you talked with them every year for 6 years, and all Michiganders.
Yes.
And you use a really interesting term for these people, Kristen, strivers. What do you mean by that word?
By that, I mean that folks were really actively engaged in all sorts of different activities to try to increase their earnings, to move into the middle class, or to maintain what little toehold they had in the middle class. So folks were going to school, trying to get associate's degrees or bachelor's degrees, trying to do training to get a better job. They were buying homes, you know, which is both a source of wealth for families in the United States, and also, you know, we think of it as a way to stabilize neighborhoods. You know, the more homeowners you have in a neighborhood, the more likely it is that people will, you know, be invested in where they live. You know, they were working as much as they could. In fact, you know, sometimes trying to start their own businesses when the jobs that they could get weren't paying enough or weren't stable enough. Unlike, you know, some popular misconceptions that are out there, you know, these are folks who are really trying their best to get ahead, but sort of no matter what happened, there were roadblocks.
So how does what you found in your study compare to what we just heard from HUD Secretary Ben Carson?
I think it takes a lot more than a mindset to rise above low earnings. It takes a lot of luck, and hard work alone is not going to do it. We've had some pretty profound changes to a lot of the institutions that used to once promote upward mobility. And so because of those changes, it's just harder to pull oneself up by one's bootstraps.
In your book, Abandoned Families, you say you have come to the conclusion that these strivers have been socially abandoned. How so and why?
Well, a number of different ways. You know, one particular aspect is just the way that higher education has changed. You know, certainly we hear a lot about, you know, how much going to college costs, but it really costs a lot if you are, you know, also trying to work at the same time, if you're trying to raise a family, and also if you have been lured in by one of these predatory for-profit institutions, you know, which promise a lot and deliver very little. And often leave people, you know, holding thousands of dollars of debt and then have a degree that's, you know, worth absolutely nothing in the labor market.
And yet our colleges and universities really are still serving that 18 to 25 year old, that traditional
right.
image of college student, aren't they?
Exactly. They're not, you know, the way that even we at the University of Michigan are designed, we are really not designed, you know, to help educate someone who doesn't kind of fit that mold, which increasingly lots of students don't.
And at the same time that's happening, we're seeing jobs changing, aren't we?
Absolutely. You know, jobs, you know, we've certainly in this area, we talk a lot about, you know, the decline of good manufacturing jobs. But, you know, with that, you know, has been the decline in unionization and just general protections that an employee used to be able to expect. So a lot of the balance of power has really shifted away from employees. You know, so it's easier to get fired. It's easier to get replaced and downsized. And those sorts of commitments that maybe once existed between employer and employee don't really exist anymore. And there are certainly incentives in our public policies for employers, you know, maybe not to think of their workers as part of the family.
And public sector jobs were such an avenue to the middle class. I'm thinking of my own father, a firefighter. We've seen that traditional pathway to the middle class for so many people. What's happening with the public sector jobs that you find?
Those are shrinking, you know, and in many states, there's been a lot of effort to, you know, kind of take away any collective bargaining power that those employees once had. But, you know, it's not a growing sector. And it not only was an important pathway, you know, to the middle class in general, but it's been an important pathway to the middle class for African Americans in our country. So it's, you know, particularly devastating to that community when those jobs have dried up.
And where have we seen job growth?
Oh, in the service sector, in the low paying service sector where, you know, jobs are unstable. They don't tend to have very good benefits, if any benefits. And there's really very little, if any, possibility for upward mobility.
So then what's the result? What kind you mentioned people working many jobs, just trying to put a patchwork quilt together of enough to live on.
Yeah. And, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how to survive, I think is the basic premise. You know, I think people who work in a lot of service sector jobs realize that, you know, this is not a career. This is not the job that you necessarily want to have for the rest of your life. But there just are so few career ladders. There's so few ways to climb up out of those jobs, you know, short of getting an education, but getting an education has become so difficult in this country.
So what is the social safety net? What does the safety net mean to these people who've been socially abandoned?
You know, for the most part, it means, you know, food stamps and Medicaid. You know, we used to have a cash welfare system, but that has almost disappeared entirely. It was reformed more than 20 years ago, which has really meant that it's much more difficult to access. If you work in a lower paying service sector job, it's harder to get things like unemployment insurance, too. You may not qualify because of the way the rules are written, or you may find yourself up against an employer who decides to contest your filing for benefits because it costs an employer anytime a worker collects benefits. So that was something I actually saw happen quite a few times when workers were laid off through no fault of their own. They had to really fight to get any benefits that they really needed and were actually entitled to.
So not enough to live on?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
And what did you find people wound up doing to survive?
Yeah, a lot of folks took on debt. You know, it came through a couple of different mechanisms. So there's been increased access to credit cards over the last several decades, which on the one hand, you know, there's positives to that. And especially now that having a good credit score counts for so many different things, sometimes employers use it as a screening tool. So having access to credit in and of itself isn't necessarily bad, but you know, the kinds of credit cards that lower income folks can get have, you know, really bad terms, high interest rates, high penalties and fees for non-payment. And if you don't earn enough to pay it back, you just have debt. And then you can, you know, find yourself having collection agencies call you. Or you have to kind of juggle things around and figure out which bills you're going to pay one month and which you're going to put to the side. And that's a really complicated game to engage in. And it puts you always at risk for having something repossessed or something shut
off. It's an emotional
off.
Calculus, isn't
it? Oh, absolutely.
Can you give us a little bit of one person's story in your book that kind of illustrates this in your mind?
Yeah. So in the book, I talk a lot about Geneva, and that's not her real name. But Geneva, I think, it really sort of epitomizes some of these challenges. You know, she had a good job. She lost it. She had an accident that happened at work. Her employer, though, fought her claim to workers' compensation benefits. It was litigated. She finally got a settlement. Actually tried to go back to work, but her employer wouldn't provide her with any kinds of the accommodations she needed. You know, something as simple as like a chair that had more back support wouldn't do that. You know, lost her job, couldn't pay the bills, lost her home, lost her car. But in all that time, as this is going on, she still, you know, was, she got disability benefits, but she wanted to do better. She wanted to go back to work. Goes to a for-profit college, ends up with a loan for about $12,000. And when she finishes, she gets a job that pays just enough to make her ineligible for any public benefits, but not enough to make ends meet. And also certainly not enough to start repaying her loan, which she was going to have to do very, very soon. And then the college went out of business. And so, you know, how much is that degree actually worth now?
So what does it look like when that safety net gets ripped with big holes or basically goes away for people like Geneva?
It just makes that scramble that already existed so much more difficult, and it's stressful. I think the levels of stress that, you know, people were experiencing, you know, were something that those of us who, you know, have relatively comfortable lives, I think, have a hard time imagining.
Well, let's take a listen to what Budget Director Mick Mulvaney said about the safety net programs that would be so drastically cut or eliminated under the Trump budget.
We're no longer going to measure compassion by the number of programs or the number of people on those programs, but by the number of people we help get off of those programs. We're not going to measure compassion by the amount of money that we spend, but by the number of people that we help.
What about that belief that safety net programs keep people dependent, keep them from moving up and out of poverty? What'd you find?
You know, I don't think that's really the case at all. One thing that public policy has done a better job of than we used to is to try to make it design programs so that families weren't sort of falling off of a cliff, that one day you're eligible, you earn a dollar more, you're no longer eligible. There's a lot more leeway in there. So some of these so-called work disincentives have really been altered. You know, I don't ever really find folks, you know, who are saying, well, I'm not going to take a job because then I'll lose this. You know, one of the things I think people don't really know as much about the safety net is that, you know, a lot of the workers, you know, the staff who administer these programs on a day-to-day basis, these are generally public employees. Their jobs have been cut back. So they're working overtime to try to process benefits. And, you know, things fall through the cracks a lot. You know, not only are benefits low paying, but it's hard to often get them just because of bureaucratic mess ups that happen. And, you know, I'm not blaming those who work in those jobs. You know, they're under a lot of pressure themselves.
And stretched very thin.
And they're stretched very, very thin. So just getting the benefits to which you're entitled to can be a real struggle. I talked to numerous folks who just, you know, lost food stamps one month for no apparent reason. You know, it was just an error. And then you have to wait months and months to get them back. So it's not a, you know, seamlessly run system.
As you study these 45 strivers and you've thought about what the policy changes could be to help them get off this hamster wheel and help them reach that goal of getting in the middle class, certainly seems like one recommendation would be just do it better.
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, we have the technology that so that we could build better systems that would distribute checks better, or, you know, we do it in other programs like Social Security. We just, you know, put up so many barriers for families who are already struggling, you know, to collect like, what, $200 a month? It's not all that much money.
What other policy changes do you think could be seriously helpful to strivers?
Yeah, I think we need to start rethinking our post-secondary education system. And it's not just, you know, for some of the women that I interviewed, but, you know, it's getting really difficult for anyone who doesn't have a lot of economic resources to get through 4 years of an undergraduate degree. And yet we really need that. And we hear employers saying they need people with skills and with the degrees. So either that means investing a lot more, you know, in financial aid, or it means somehow restructuring, you know, how we do higher ed, or probably actually a combination of the two.
If the budget proposals that we've seen in President Trump's budget are enacted, or even if Congress adopts less drastic but significant cuts to all of these social safety net programs we've been talking about. What do you see for the people we meet in your book?
Oh, you know, it's hard to think about. I think, you know, people are resourceful, right? So, you know, folks will figure out a way to make do. There are a couple of different things I worry about. You know, people's challenges aren't going to go away. I think just the burden of helping will get shifted elsewhere. So I worry about what this will do to extended family networks. Will it mean that people who are a little bit better off economically will have to step in and help more of their kin? And, you know, that's not something that's necessarily, you know, we don't think of that as bad. We, you know, helping each other, helping friends, helping families.
But if they're just on the edge, what a drain to them.
Absolutely. And over a long enough period of time, this really then can have negative effects on upward mobility for generations. If, you know, if no one can get ahead because everyone's always helping each other, you know, that keeps people stuck for generations. You know, our so private safety net system, the nonprofits, the food pantries, you know, the meal programs, you know, those are shoestring programs anyway. They always have been, even in the best of times. You know, are they going to be taxed that much more because, you know, we've now cut the food stamp rolls down? You know, I think there's absolutely no problem with saying that we want to, you know, reduce our caseloads, but you know, how are we doing that? You know, are we doing that because we're helping people, you know, become better off and you know, have incomes high enough that they no longer need the program? Or are we just cutting to cut?
The book is Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century by Kristen Seafeld, who is a professor at the Ford School of Public Policy and at the School of Social Work at the University of Michigan. It was great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Join us tomorrow as we continue our series looking at the working poor in Michigan. We'll talk with a mother of three struggling to make ends meet in Albion.
Are we going to have a home to live in next month? Are our bills going to be paid? Are we going to have a vehicle? You know, we just get out and make sure that they don't have to ever worry about those stresses and that we take on that.
That is tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Executive producer of Stateside is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Petulano Ali, Jacob Meschke, and Tyler Scott. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.